Chairperson, thank you for this opportunity. It is a question that we have dealt with in various formats. We, as the services from Parliament, have dealt with this issue about whether members of the executive or even other role players in the economy or government that do not want to appear or do not want to disclose things for various reasons to a committee. I think, Chairperson, the vantage point, of course, would be Section 56 of the Constitution, which gives the power to the National Assembly as well as committees to call, to request information or to request a person to appear before it. And if that doesn't happen, to summon a person or to summon a person to present that information or to hand over a report or whatever. Now, sir, that of course must be understood in the mandate of the National Assembly. Focus just on the National Assembly, not on the other House or on the joint issues. So, Chair, the mandate we know is set out in Section 55 of the Constitution, and especially Section 55.2 that says the National Assembly must maintain oversight over the exercise of national executive authority, including the implementation of legislation. It's much wider than that, but for the purpose of this briefing, you can focus on that. So that's there, and I want to put that there to one side and to say, let's see what the Minister of State Security is saying to the committee. Minister of State Security says that, as I understand the brief, as I understand the correspondence, that he would appear, and then that he couldn't appear, but the Deputy Minister would appear. And then he wrote to say, the Deputy Minister, neither the Deputy Minister nor him will appear, because the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence, in terms of Section 2.1 of the Intelligence Services Oversight Act, determined that they must go to the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence. So, Chair, I can project it, but the Section 2.1, I just want to take the committee to Section 2.1. Section 2.1 of the Intelligence Services Oversight Act says that there is hereby established a parliamentary committee to be known as the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence, which shall, and I want to emphasize the next one, subject to the Constitution, perform the oversight function set up in this Act. And in the opinion that I've distributed, or that you told me, or whoever distributed, I quote the functions of the JSEI, the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence. That's set out in Section 3 of the Intelligence Service Oversight Act. And those functions are quite wide-ranging, but first of all, one must notice that they're not exclusive to the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence. But everyone would say, why would you want to duplicate things if the Act says, for instance, that the audit of financial statements, the audit report, Committee of Intelligence. The audited financial statements of the security services, specifically the SSA, the Space Security Agency, must go to the JSCI for them to report thereon. It doesn't mean that SCOPA can't look at those documents, but SCOPA will not report on it. The Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence will report on it. Simply because, in terms of the structure of Parliament, you have a joint committee that reports to both houses on the intelligence service, and that's required in terms of the constitution. So SCOPA can't report to the NCOP, for instance. So we have the report coming from there, and we have a non-exclusive mandate of the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence. They cannot say that only us that can look at these things. Now, Chair, I'm saying that subject to, of course, the issue of national security, I'm saying subject to issues of confidentiality. If those issues are there, if a minister or the accounting authority of a security agency raises issues of confidentiality, of course we consider that. In terms of the constitution, in terms of the rules of the National Assembly, something or information, if it's justifiable and reasonable in an open democratic society to exclude the media and the public from certain meetings, it can be done. Of course, one can challenge it, but there are reasons why certain things should be closed. Might be issues of privacy, might be issues of national security. So, Chair, I want to leave it there, but I want to say to the committee, I want to advise the committee that Section 2.1, which is the reason preferred by the minister, is subject to the Constitution. The Constitution gives the National Assembly the right to call for information. SCOPA is a mechanism of the National Assembly. Specifically, Section 55.1 says that National Assembly must establish these mechanisms to ensure that accountability and oversight. Now, SCOPA is one of those. So, in my opinion, as well as those of my colleagues in my office, is that SCOPA is within its rights to call for the information, namely the briefing on the progress with the vetting of certain officials or all officials at state and enterprises. I do not think the minister's reason in law takes account of the constitutional mandate of Parliament. The question that may arise, why are we having two different ways of interpreting Section 2.1 of the Intelligence Service Oversight Act, Chair, in the opinion, I raised the issue of interpretation of legislation at a certain point, and I refer to the Natal Pension Fund case, I refer to the Bartuszar Constitutional Court case, which clearly set out how one should interpret legislation, that one should use a contextual interpretation, namely to take account of the Constitution as well when we are interpreting legislation, as well as other issues, but I'll just leave it with the Constitution, that's all that's necessary. So Chair, I just want to conclude that the issue of oversight of SOEs, and this is maybe a bit above my pay grade, but I'm going to do it in any case, Chair, with your indulgence. The issue of SOEs, has been set up in the National Development Plan as a critical factor for the success of the developmental state. And the reasons, if I can remember correctly, in the NDP is that there is a lack of oversight, there is a lack of accountability with SOEs. So Chair, that is something that Parliament needs to address. I mean, I've set out now that Parliament and the National Assembly specifically, as well as SCOPA, the mechanism from the National Assembly, has certain powers. And in my understanding of the Constitution, in my understanding of certain Constitutional Court cases, I can refer to the EFF case, which considered the Nkanda matter, Parliament is not only empowered to do oversight, Parliament is required to do it. So Parliament must do it. So if you need, as a committee, to get an information briefing, then the committee is required to pursue that path. And I've mentioned the importance of SOEs and the lack of oversight over them and their challenges of playing their role in a developmental stage. So it is a critical matter. So I just wanted to leave it there. Thank you very much, Chair. Any questions before I end?
All right. Thank you very much. So it's another matter of Parliament. So bye. That's great. Let's move on 1 minute and we thank you for your attention. I think it was a high level summary because the opinion has taken its rate, so colleagues will build up on that. Honourable Van Minen and Honourable Mendel.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much, Mr. Jenkins, for that opinion. It's not the first time we've had this kind of tussle with the SSA. We had a matter earlier in the year, and the advice we received then was similar, the judge did not have an exclusive mandate. and that there certainly are avenues that we can pursue this further. Now, in terms of this time match, I mean, very clearly, the need for SCOPA to oversight the SOEs and the vetting process is frankly being frustrated by the Minister and by his viewpoint. Now, taking on board what you were saying in terms of your advice, going forward, what would our options be? I mean, does one just go with the summons? I know that another committee has as recently summoned the Minister who refused, who still refused, and then are further steps being taken. Where does one really go from here to really enforce the duty the SCOPA then has to in fact perform oversight? It is very clearly being frustrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Partly covered by my member. And the problem I have is that FSA has come, if I remember correctly, what I can have on top of my head, two times in the previous parliament, where in one occasion we even dealt with it was Minister Dodo. We even dealt with the matter of
fifth parliament and the sixth parliament.
And the fifth year.
Minister Bongo, fifth parliament, Minister Dodo, sixth parliament.
And we dealt with the matter of them amending the standard rules and all of that. But my problem, which I want to get from this clarification, is is there a part of SSA that they cannot disclose to SOPA? And if there is, what would inform that? Because as far as I understand it, that we are a parliamentary mechanism in order to exercise the oversight and ensuring that every service delivery is not hindered, and also police the funds and the expenditure thereof. So if there is anything that the SCOPA has to close, what could that be in terms of meeting with the SSA? Because at some point, there was an intimidation that if we can order the closed meeting, they will come. But as SCOPA, we can't close anything. We are a public operating under the standards and rules of parliament, because we are policing the funds of the public, which is the taxpayer, and we are also looking into the matter of service delivery for the people, and that's the current term.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Sonia, and then we'll go to
thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Minister, for returning to the brief summation of their opinion. I agree with what Honourable Manchet is coming up with, that if indeed it was only for the first time that we are in this kind of situation, would require some information from SSA, one would understand. And I fail to understand that indeed there have been interactions my time there with Minister Tawaka, who came herself to give us a briefing on the same matter, which is to virtually nothing else. Even at that time, we were to receive a further a briefing note if you have had. So our required action is directed on a particular matter which affects departments that we direct with. And it's a matter which affects service delivery. ESCOM is massive. Affects matters that relate to procurement, and you see the depth of it, the negativity that it comes up with, and therefore we are coming up this way to ask the the direct responsible organ of the state to have some kind of a reaction with us on that particular matter, which leads to that change. Well, I would have some understanding if it were going to be matters which are going to be dealt much on security aspects, which are of a society of their own profile. I can refer that I've been invited to extend that would require such a kind of interaction as they do. So I respect that. I respect the fact that yes, indeed, they have that institutional arm which handles this matter. But ours was specific, directed, and the minister came, even this minister indicated that it's going to come up until someone said, you know, might be this way or that way in terms of this. So the relevance of the question, where then now, is the next day when the case came about. We don't want to indeed delve into their own issues. Those departments report to us. That concerns this number of officials that change. This number not that change. Because SSA is not responding well on these points. And therefore, for us it is imperative to get to them. What is it that he does? So that's the only question that we want to do. So,
thank you very much. I think it must be reiterated that it is not without precedent that they have appeared before. It must not be taken as least a new thing. As Honourable Minister says, 2017 Minister, then Minister Bongo appeared, in the 6th Parliament Minister Loyo appeared. On this issue, it's not a new matter. And so I really would just want to stress that particular point. I think though, colleagues, our leaning towards all our meetings being open must not mean that where necessary insofar as the SOP of Parliament is concerned on matters of national security, those rules won't apply. But the matter before us is not in that case. It's not about and we're not delving into that space in any case. So I thought I should say that we will abide by the rule, but I'm adamant that in this case we are well within our rights. And so I think, Edward Jenkins, you confirmed our outlook in the legal terms. So you can respond to the questions that members have posed. And I was, of course, reading page 26 here of the legal opinion, which says, should the minister refuse to report to SCOPA, SCOPA may initiate the process to summon the minister to provide the same information. So that option remains available to us on this matter. And I think the final point is, which must be stressed, we are actually here advancing a cabinet resolution of 2014 that people in the SCM stage and the executives of the Soviets must be vetted. The matter is their own decision, which has got a material bearing to public funds. So I can't find now how it becomes a secret thing to be done in the shadows. Just, the whole thing is incoherent. that's the logic they follow. But advocates want to know.
Thank you, Chair. I think what was said by yourself and the previous honourable member is 100% correct. The issue of the honourable member also asked when we draw the line between various areas that SSI is working. But certainly, insofar as there are public funds involved, insofar as SCOPA has a mandate to look at the expenditure of public funds, and the specific mandate of SCOPA is to receive audit financial statements and to comment on those audit reports basically from the Auditor General. And that's why all audit financial statements are referred to SCOPA. Those referrals, this is the relevance of what I'm saying, but those referrals usually go hand in hand with the annual report being referred to a portfolio committee, which then looks at sort of day-to-day happenings within that department, whether there was an achievement, to what extent it was 100%, what achievement was there for strategic outputs that were identified in the strategic plan, the annual performance plan, what was said in that, that the department achieve those. So the portfolio committee will look at that. When we come to the state security agency and we want to deal with those matters, the Act, which we refer to earlier, the Intelligence Service Oversight Act, is clear that goes to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence. It doesn't matter for Parliament, it's a joint function, it's a joint issue. So there's a clear line there. None of those should be necessarily in camera, in a closed meeting. But as the rules stand at the moment, we start with the Constitution. The Constitution says all committee meetings are open, unless it's reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society to close a committee meeting of Parliament. So the default position is openness. The Joint Planning Committee of Intelligence, in terms of the Act, is a closed committee, and in terms of the rules, is a closed committee. So there are reasons that one can then deduce from that why it's always a closed committee. One of the advantages of that committee, as was mentioned, is that the members are vetted, so they deal with top secret information. It's a step further than just closing the committee. So the question now is what goes where, what can SCOPA do, what can SCOPA not do? Well, SCOPA is completely within its power to exercise its mandate, to look at the expenditure of public funds, and to request information that's relevant to that. I would say about the SCOPA or not. The SCOPA can't call the minister and try and explain to the committee what are the methodologies used to do better. That might be secret, might be classified. SCOPA is interested to know, is the work being done? Are the money being spent? Do we add value to money? And if there's an audit report that finds fault with that, we want to interrogate that audit report, and we want to speak to the actors, the accounting officers, the executive authority of those departments, I assume and I know that, because I've worked with SCOPA for a long time, those things have been planned. We've had the National Development Plan, we see there are problems with SOE. So SCOPA wants to know what are we doing about these problems with SOE, and why are we debating and the cabinet decisions we want to deal with. SCOPA can do that in my opinion. What SCOPA cannot do is if we look at the Intelligence Oversight Act, and I'm just using it as an example, what SCOPA cannot do is to, for instance, call for that report of the evaluation committee. The evaluation committee evaluates the work of the SOE. The evaluation committee is not a parliament committee. So if I can't ask them about the methodologies about that's for the JSE and finally. So really, SOE, we need to really explain to the minister or the accounting officer or public if they want to call a judge to interrogate whether the judge has complied or how the judge complied with the regulation of interception of communications and provision of communicated related information Act of 2002. Now that gives the power to certain judges, designated judges, to allow the interception of communication. They might be referred in some cases. And for SCOPA to have interest in that, SCOPA would have to put out its mandate to say, what interest does SCOPA have to get that information? Might be one thing to say how much is spent exercise and whether there was value for money. Skopo might want that interest, but Skopo doesn't have an interest in the reasons of the judges and how they performed it and why certain people were then asked to be monitored or not. I'm just saying that in general, just to show that there are areas where there would be a line that Skopo couldn't go to. But that's not a necessarily a Chinese war one. You have to look at exactly what context, who is in which or where in which the Skopo wants to use that information. And if it is classified, nothing stops Skopo from interrogating the matter and to say, we need to go to the procedure set out in the NA rules. It starts with the committee or the chair closing the meeting, looking at the information, saying, do you want to close this committee meeting to consider this information? If the committee decides yes, then Parliament can close it. Of course, it can be challenged. There's an administrative procedure where we advise the committee advise the chairperson of committees, ITT, I think on authority at the moment, just advise the office, we are considering this information, we want to advise you that you can close the meeting to consider this information, we just want you to be aware of it, because usually it is, for lack of a better word, it might be sensational, it might be media worthy, but Parliament, the default position is to have open meetings, and therefore closing the meeting usually people are asking why you're closing the meeting. Has Skopo done it before? Yes, Skopo has done it before. Has Skopo received information that has to be closed? Yes. I mean, I think it started specifically with the joint investigation team's report, the procurement of Gripen around about 2000-2001. It started in 1998, I think, and then that whole report was a joint investigation team of which Skopo and Auditor General and so forth were part. But that information that Skopo could interrogate was locked up in the speaker's safe at that point in time. And Skopo had to go there to look at it and to come back and then discuss it in the first meeting, so it can happen. So Chair, going forward, I would say, Chair, is to respond to the letter of the minister and say, even if that's the legal opinion, you're free to do that, to say that he received legal advice. The committee is not convinced that the legal basis for refusing to and we request the minister to appear and to share that information with the deputy minister, telling you stop for the margin option because it's a requirement. Not an option, but to summon you to get that information and to proceed with our work. That is my advice. So, Chair, I'd like to address myself on all of the issues if there's something else I'm still here, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think it's pretty clear. I was exactly along those lines that you would write to the minister in the presidency, who's also responsible for state security, and inform him that the committee does not agree with his position, and re-invite him again to appear before the committee at a later time that will be determined by the program, and failing thereof, I advise them to reserve the right to issue a summons. It will be the last resort, but if we need to invoke it, then we will invoke it. The issue is very simple. It's vetting in critical spaces. SCM and ESCOM has been reporting on this matter, there are shortcomings. So I don't think it's complicated. So we will inform the minister accordingly. I'm just getting a date here. But colleagues, it seems as if the 30th of November is open to us. It's an open date. It's the day before Parliament rises, the 1st of December. There's nothing sorted. So can we tentatively place this matter for the 30th of November so that we close the day? So we will, And if there's any development, the colleagues are advised. So the meeting is penciled in for the 30th of November, and we will advise the minister accordingly that we've considered his correspondence, we want to agree with it, then he is invited to come and report. Is that in order, colleagues? Thank you very much, Advocate Jenkins. An absolute pleasure. I know you're a busy man. We are pulling you from all directions. Azaban? Department and the former employer, which must furnish whatever the matter of due process, not because there's anything, you know, Mr. Gubia untoward, but I think he must get it from the but we will look at it, and I will consult you that will advocate Mr. Jenkins on that one. Colleagues, let me thank. Advocate Jenkins, what you?
Thank you, Chair. Whilst I understand the rationale, so the committee is not the distributor of the information. This was a report that was commissioned by the Minister of Higher Education. We're talking about the report about the Rabbit Fund.
And then that was a report of the National Security Fund on the distribution of disposable funds to institutions. It arose out of the controversy when they had the schema on the schema. They redirected that they investigate a sample set project and produce the report. The Minister wanted the report to be classified. Yes, and for 4 years. Yeah, and then we said no. Yeah, so sorry, that's what I
meant. Chair, the Promotion of Access to Information Act actually provides that if an organised state has information or has a record that has been requested, although it might not be the author of that record, if it has that record, if it can be distributed, that it is distributed by that organisation. So nothing stops this committee from sharing that information, but you are also correct, and we do it, that we advise the same way on different other reports to say, look, it's really what you're requesting is the author there, it sits there, please get it there. I mean, we recently responded to that to say this is actually the Auditor General has that report, it's not asked from Parliament, but nothing stops a person when they do not get it there to come to Parliament and say, it was considered in your committee, I know you have the report, I know it's public, you've tabled it, you've discussed it. Please give me a copy, and you will not be, you will actually comply with the access to hand over the report.
No, it's no problem, you can get the report, okay, you can get the report. First, thank you very much. With the distance, let's not keep you. I see the NDPP is already outside. They will set up, and then we'll start colleagues promptly. Thank you very much for this. Let's get the Hawks and the NPA and the SIU in room, we set them up and then we'll be good to go. Talk the coin. start. All right, so the host will go first. All right. And then we will take questions, colleagues, of both presentations. So we'll take a presentation first, and then to say to General MDPP, please take the presentation as read, because there was that. So you need not go into so the high level presentation will help, and I'm also cognizant of the request that was made to also the slight challenges as well. So colleagues, the meeting must rise at 2 today. In any case, we've got a fully fledged session this afternoon, a question session at 3, and then Dora is starting at 6, so we do have a long day in any case. So I think we are amicable to the 2 o'clock request that was placed. But it's also in your hands on how you present. But we are open to the high-level presentation. Colleague, are you fine? Nishab?
Thank you. Well,
just I must always make sure we have our eyes. All right, so MDPP, General, HOU, we're in your hands. Good morning and welcome to everyone. Let's dive right into it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Good morning, and also morning to my colleagues, the National Director of Public Prosecution, Advocate Kapoor, the head of the Special Investigating Unit, Advocate Mutibi, the colleagues from the Auditor General, and all the other colleagues. From the DPCI side is myself, accompanied by the 18 component head of the Serious Commercial Crime Environment. He has been acting in this environment since the 1st of June when the incumbent was appointed in another post. We expect that we will be filling that post with effect from the 1st of December. That is next month. We delayed because of the issue of top secret vetting. That is something that also delayed some of the appointments that we are doing. We are also intending to be, we have this month appointed or promoted 244 of the personnel, including those that we have taken from the greater SAPS into the house, those that have applied the requirement. So our capacity has now grown to now over 50%. We are now sitting at 52%. We are intending to be appointing another 290 with effect from the 1st of January. We are currently doing the selection process where there is more than 50,000 applications that we must sift through. We are building the capacity of the DPCI to be able to respond to the volume of work on hand. So with those remarks, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, I will be requesting Brigadier Makinyane to present on behalf of the DPCI. As it has been indicated that the report should be considered as read, we shall try his best to talk to the presentation and not read. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, the head of the National, the NCP, the head of the SIU, will be presenting on the situation of the HOPS. I have taken note of what the Chair said, that the presentation should be taken as already read by the honourable members. Only what I will do now, I will maybe get into slides that hearing on our presentation are not only the starting cases where they were referred from SIU. We have included the cases that are for the entities that the National Network is to present. The presentation shows the number of cases that are at court and the number of investigations. We can see as a total, the number of court cases is 34. That runs out for 3, 4, 17, water sanitation, 1 case. SA, we don't have a case on the court road, transnet, 12, 1, SAPC, which makes 34. There are figures that we have also on the amount of work that we put there. But the figures, at times we estimate the figures while the letters are still under investigation, and at the end of the investigation, when the charge is formulated, then there will be correct figures that will talk to the case. We do have cases that are under investigation on the entities, and the total there is 98. We also have open cases that were finalized. One on Gaza, 13 on Eskom, and 2 on water. The development of water sanitation in total is 15 cases. We do have only one letter, which is on the court road. It's a KZN letter that involves Katuze water board. We've got 3 cases that were submitted for. 9 cases are under investigation and 2 matters were finalized. And then the next slide are indicating the court cases that are appearing in the court. Some of the dates, maybe on the copies that the honourable members and the chair have, some of the court dates have also been updated after we have submitted. I will not be going through case by case. I will just go to the cases that were finalized after the court cases. We do have one matter, which was an Eastern matter on the Amatola water, which was finalized, but that one was finalized because there could not be any sufficient evidence. Then on the cases under investigation, we have got figures there, we've got Eastern Cape 2, 3 or something, Bongo 2, KwaZulu-Natal 2, Natal, and Mbalan 1. The total number of cases already obtained on those 10 cases is 173, and the total amount is over 1 billion, which is the total amount of those 10 cases. Then we do have Eskom matters, we've got 96, and we have indicated the cases pending the court, which are 17, cases submitted for decision is 6, cases under investigation is 55, cases finalized is 13. I can indicate that the bulk of the matters there at Eskom is cases that were some generated by police operations, some they talked to suspects who were arrested in possession of suspected stolen property, cables, and it involves also cases that took the death of people and also on Transnet, most of the cases when people have been arrested stealing the fuel on the pipelines, damage to the infrastructure. So our lot also be communicating, very on the cases that are pending in court, but the data has been updated. Then the cases under investigation of Transnet 7 and a total number of 59 statements have been obtained on the 7 cases. The total amount is about 3 million. And then SAPC, South African Broadcasting Corporation, we have 2 cases. One matter is pending in court and one case is under investigation. The matter that is pending in court then on the one measure which is under investigation, 4 statements have already been obtained and the amount is about 18,000. And then the network of 2 matters which are both under investigation. The total statements, the 3 statements that have been obtained on the 2 matters which are under investigation, the total amount is about 4.3 billion. Then we've got a passenger rail agency of South Africa, SPRASA, with a total of 21 matters. Cases pending on the court floor is 30 matters. Cases that are in investigation is 17, and one matter was finalized. The matter which is at court the matters that are under investigation are 17, and a total number of 857 statements have already been obtained on 17 matters. The amount, the total amount involved, about 6.8 billion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that. I'll be much
past this introduction, we move to the next slide as well. We move on. If we go to slide 6, thank you very much. So, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, just to explain that, in essence, both the SIU investigation as well as the Rwanda Commission, they capture investigation. And it's important to note, in as much as they're really important, the SIU investigation has a very high standard. Ultimately, we have to meet the standard for criminal prosecutions, and therefore, in terms of the SIU Act, after their investigation, the matters are then referred to the NPA for further investigations, building on the work that they have done in order to ensure that we actually meet those criminal standards. And so it's really important, particularly in the context of the Rwanda Commission work, and maybe much of the work that we do flows from that. It's important to note that in as much as it remains a very important point of reference for the work of the investigative agencies, the DGCI, the IB, and the NPA, whether or not a person has, a name of a person has been mentioned or has not been mentioned in the Zonda Commission report will not be determinative of whether or not a prosecution ensued. So it's very important to make that point because we need to ensure that the relevant evidence is collected and that the criminal standard is met before matters can be enrolled. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, what I can say, and it's not just my say, so hopefully you will also note that the tide is indeed turning. In the past 6 months, well, we've reported to SCOPA, this is our third appearance before SCOPA this year. We appeared in February and March, I think, in fairly quick succession, and now in November. But since we were last here, we have really been extremely hard at work in order to ensure that we are able to set up what we say an NPA that is fit for purpose, that can do the job that the country, the citizens of this country expect us to do. And so the progress that has been seen in the past 6 months is certainly by design and not by default. It takes a lot of hard work to get to where we are. We're certainly not where we want to be. There's a lot of work to be done. But we are much more capacitated and in a better position now to be able to move with the cases and the matters that are before us. The investigating directorate, which is really important, particularly with regard to state capture matters, it has stable and competent leadership. And a really important aspect of the collapse, the cases that you see coming to court now, has been collaboration. And I cannot overemphasize the need for all the stakeholders in law enforcement, but also in the private sector for us to work together so that we can deal with these cases with the relevant resources as well. And so, we committed to enrolling 9 seminal cases before September. Which we did, and these are really key cases. That it's not by any means, as I said, there's still a lot of work, but these cases indicate that the wheels of justice are indeed turning. Next slide. There have been various measures that we've put in place, Chair, to try to ensure that cases move quickly to court. An important one is the establishment of a joint task force between the NPA and the DPPR. We've actually, within the NPA, there are various units, business units as well, and it's important that there's collaboration between these business units as well to understand where exactly the cases are, whether it's in the FCCU, in the ID, whether the AFU is playing a part here, whether the tax unit is playing a part, and there's also been very, very good cooperation with the SARS. We also would invite either the FIC or the FIU to these meetings as required. And the main mandate of this is to drive the coordination between these various entities. And there's other coordination structures, and they're all mentioned in the slides, and I'm going to go through there. Co-location, we're looking at
together with DPCI, collocation of investigators and prosecutors in key matters, and this is particularly with the assistance of the private sector, and hopefully you'll be able to see the fruits of these endeavors as having adolescent prosecutors investigators sitting in one place and working together on key cases is a really good practice. And we also, as I mentioned, building partnerships, because we do think we need to be bold and innovative in terms of trying to get all the resources that we need to rebuild our country. In particular, looking at the shortage of specialized skills in our space, as well as I know that my colleagues are also struggling with these challenges. Next slide. We continue the ID. The establishing of the ID as a permanent entity is a really important step in the fight against corruption. And so this will actually be useful for many reasons, and I mentioned them, but particularly to attract the necessary skills and people with the relevant qualifications to ensure that when permanence comes security of Kenya, one of the challenges we saw is that getting skills in, and then when there's a permanent position outside of the ID, colleagues will leave. So this is a really important issue, and it will definitely result in us being able to continue with our investigation. And of course, the independence issue is critical. Permanence does require legislative changes, and so I want to caution that we would like Parliament to assist us in fast-tracking this so that we can get the legislation changed. But in the meantime, we have requested the Minister to grant ID investigators peace officer powers in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, and hopefully that will come through very, very soon. We will go for a high-level overview of all the cases. As you will note there, that there are some of these matters that we are dealing with, not all of them have come through SIU referrals, but we're working very, very closely with all of the relevant entities. I'll leave it at that, Chair, and hand over to Mr. Cock, who will take you through some of the referrals that we are dealing with regard to state domain enterprises. Mr. Cock, thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
and
good morning. At the outset, from an operational point of view, we have just been advised that we've concluded our inputs from the various state agencies into a memorandum of understanding that will govern the operational way in which we will work together as law enforcement agencies. This MOU will be sent from our office tomorrow to all the heads of the respective agencies, including SIU, the DCI, a national commissioner, and it will speak to how we will organize the work relevant to the SIU and how we will engage each other in a collaborative way to ensure that we can enhance the speed in which we do the work and that we can enhance the quality of the work and that we can collaborate in terms of the approaches and the strategies that we are going to embark upon in terms of the investigations of these matters. Now this is very important because some of the challenges we have been experiencing is because of the disjointed way in which we've been approaching some of the work. So we are happy to report that there's a lot of work that's been happening at the operational level to strengthen the manner in which we work, and we're confident that going forward we are going to enhance everything that we do as law enforcement agencies. So just on the PRASA matter, that will be reflected on the screen. We are going to be in discussions with the SIU to assign prosecutors to the project team that is working to investigate that matter. So that's going to be, for us, it's going to be an important development because when the SIU identifies a particular investigation that justifies the involvement of the prosecutor at an early stage. We are now going to say we will assign the prosecutor to that team, and that is going to help us to really fast track those investigations. So I think from our side, as the NPA, we will want to review all of the big projects that we are currently involved with, SIU, and see which one of those we want to assign a prosecutor to work with the investigators. And this will also be the approach with the DCR. So once we have a project team of that nature working together, it will just strengthen the manner in which we can do our work going forward. By the time the report is written by the SIU, a prosecutor will really be engaged quite extensively with evidence and the quality of evidence and the outstanding evidence for purposes by court would already have been collected. So I think that was the major challenge that we always had in dealing with these matters, and if we can reach that, it will really be a game changer in terms of the way we're going to work together. So from my side, I'm just flagging a few of the high-level matters from the prosecution side. Of course, the ID is also now involved in various investigations. They will speak immediately after me, and then the Assets Forfeiture Unit that's extensively involved in all of the big matters will then come in and explain the report. So the first one speaks to the Department of Water and Sanitation, and we just at a high level state that there are 19 matters with the prosecution service, 10 of these referrals were recently received during the course of this year. I'm not going to go through the rest of the detail. We can move to the SABC. Currently, in the prosecution service, there are 7 matters referred to the prosecution service. One case is currently partly in court. 2 cases have been declined to prosecute, and 4 of those matters are still under investigation. One of the matters in court, the party of the matter is postponed to the 1st of December 2022. The SABC Group Executive Sports Division matter statement is sorry, not showing. That case is currently on the court floor. We can move to the next slide. These are the CASA investigations. The CASA investigations straddles the focus area of the SIU, the ID, and the DCI. Of course, the Asset Forfeiture Unit is involved in all of the CASA work. And flowing from the Zambia Commission reports, there were various recommendations that were done. Prior to the Zondo reports, work was already done in this space. And so, as I understand from the SIU, there is going to be a rescoping from their side as well in terms of what further investigation needs to relate to the crossover. And this is where I give the example that we spoke to the SIU to say that prosecutors will be assigned. So currently, there are 3 matters within the prosecution service. These matters are all under the division of the Director of Public Prosecutor in Johannesburg, and they are still under the investigative stage. One part of those investigations have recently been enrolled, and the CASA matter relating to Bambo is currently one of the priority matters within the prosecution service, and it's being monitored on what we call a committee, a special committee of very senior people, where we place cases that we need to speedily advance. So CASA is going to receive a lot of attention from all of us, and hopefully our coordinated efforts will bring better results in terms of bringing cases to the court trials. On page 16, we set out some of the measures that are being implemented in terms of dealing with CASA cases. So at this stage of the presentation, we will refer to
ID, but Matthew Sokol is present and he's the head of investigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I'll take you through the presentation for the investigative directorate. Chairperson, the first slide speaks to the mandate and how the investigative directorate is proclaimed, and made a point that how the directorate started its work over through reassignment of first leaders to the NPA and secondment of investigators from SATS, so that is how basically the IT was taken from this. The second slide talks to the powers and functions, what we're able to do in terms of our current powers as provided for in Chapter 5 of the NPA Act. And then we make a point also that we're able to conduct these investigations because of these secondments that they would receive from the other law enforcement agencies. The next slide, Chairperson, talks to the mission of the ID and how it has approached to the ID and how the ID authorizes centers for investigation. And the next slide, Chairperson, talks to the matter that you are investigating, and this slide shows the overview of matters that you were dealing with in the IT space. We indicate that the main matters that are under investigation, and then on the reason why we're taking long, this will be discussed in the next slides from slide 23 to 6, and then we don't have any matters with on, and the reason for the law is not relevant. We have five letters that are before court. The next slide, we deal in more detail about the matters that we deal with. The first one there is the ESCOM and Transnet subcontract, and the values involved there is 545 million for Transnet and 555 million for ESCOM. We indicate the offences that were investigating, and we're investigating basically the unlawful conduct in relation to how these contracts were entered into. Currently, this matter is under investigation, Jefferson, and the reason why the investigation is taking long is because of the complex nature of these investigations. And then the next slide talks to the Transnet NeoTel contract. We indicate also the offences that were investigated in the contract level 8.4. We indicate the offences, and then also the matter still under investigation, and the same reason the complex nature of this investigation is present. And the next one is cutting edge contract with Transnet, similar with the unlawfulness of this contract, and the reason that the investigation is taking long is because of the complex nature of this investigation. And the next one is the relocation matter, and we indicate there also that under investigation and the complex nature of those investigations. The next one is the SSA matter, which was recently authorized and just started the investigation there. The next one is still SSA Mumbai and Uganda. It's similar also in relation to that. And then the next talks to institutional impediments, we make a point about skilled and capable investigators and prosecutors should be able to trust in the scope of these investigations, and that sometimes we do not have the skills within government, and the remuneration skills within government to accept that appropriate skills to deal with these kind of matters. And a major point also about the digital information investigation capability that we don't have sometimes, and the terabytes of data that we have to deal with. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to my colleague.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members, for this opportunity to present the involvement of AUFU in the SIU development. So the AUFU presentation is two slides, Chairperson and members. We start on slide 40. So basically, this slide brings us back to the prevention of organized crime. We normally call it COCA, where the AUPP has to be respect to assets to cover the measure in terms of chapter 2 chapters. Chapter 5, which is taking, where the criminal investigation and going to prosecution or non-conviction based prosecution to cover the cost of unlawful activity and instrumentalities of offense. So the one way is waiting for a case to investigate and prosecute perhaps to get a conviction. The other way is where we do an analysis and we can see that these are process of time. We don't have to wait for criminal investigation and prosecution to finalize. So the AFU then is there to take the profit out of crime. It has been established there to give effect to those chapters that allow the NDPP to then proceed to do recovery. So in determining the asset profit potential for any matter, the AFU is guided and relying on what we call the support. We rely on the financial intelligence center report, and because our investigative agencies, staff, CCI and the IB, then we've got our own financial investigators and analysts to determine the global fund. So slide 42, chapters and members, is to how we are involved broadly with SIU referrals. So you get referrals direct from SIU to AUFU, or it can come through the investigative agencies, or it can come through prosecution. And in all this, SIU is also able to do recoveries in the tribunal, SIU tribunal, or some matter can be referred to the asset for the tribunal. Slide 43, chapters and members, just to go through some of the SIU referral methods, and you mentioned that in this slide there were two methods where two SIU methods were referred by the SIU after the orders were already obtained. The first one was the McKinsey consultancy fees, where on the 14th of December 2017, on the 7th of July 2018, and then the proclamation was only published later. As I said, it came from the investigative agency or a guidance from SIU. Then we also then obtained almost a $2 billion order for the mine rehabilitation fund case on the 26th of April, and the proclamation was published 20 days after we obtained the order. Moving along to slide 44, then have got in total chapters and members, 7 ESCOM members, including the 2 of the first two that we have obtained. The 11.7 million, which was obtained on the 9th of November 2021. The criminal matter is still ongoing, in that we have still also not finalized the restraint matter, meaning the prosecution is proceeding. The next matter, which is matter number 5, is the, what we call the Gupta mine. That comes together of Optima coal mine and terminal, where we obtained a preservation order of 3.9 million on the 23rd of March 2022, and we're about to go to court to finalize the forfeiture proceedings. There are a lot of many interlocutory proceedings in this matter, but we've already applied to the DJP in Pretoria to call a case management meeting so that the matter can settle down and for finalization. In the chapter 50 matter, there are no criminal proceedings instituted as yet, and we take a rule of the finalized as soon as the hearings are completed. Now, linked to this Gupta mine is the Templar creditor claim of 1.3 billion, which is another preservation order and is linked to the 3.9 billion, and the matter will be heard at the same time where we are going to turn up for future proceedings as soon as the international applications are resolved. Then we got one SAA matter, which is Buma matter, which is legal sale of aircraft park, where a restraint amount, the prison order, where criminal proceedings are involved, is 5 million, which was obtained on the 5th July 2021. Now, the next two matters, Transnet matters, which is Albertine Moody and Raisman Capital, is matters that appear under the ID, the Investigative Director of Use, as consultancy agreement as well as locomotive. So we have dealt with them as Albertine Moody. So Moody and his company Albertine, and we obtained the restraint or the prison order of 2-3 million on the 21 June 2020. So the matter is still ongoing, it's in court. And then Regiment Capital, we have restrained 1.6 billion, and we have looked at the role that the Regiment Capital Directors played in the consultancy agreement as well as 1054 locomotive matters. So it's those two matters that I've mentioned that are going to be linked to criminal proceedings. And the last matter, that's from matter number 7, is NTP versus Moyo, where we obtained a restraint order, and the matter that was referred to us by SIU Direct, pertains to illegal awarding of a contract of 400 million by one of the officials in Excom, and obtained a 24 million preservation order. And the other way we change letters, labels, and how. Thank you. That's the end of the interview presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's the last one, right?
So this matter, we obtained the preservation order on the 9th of
No, you're fine. I'm just saying that Kivich wasn't
all
right for the discovery.
Yeah, so probably by the day I'll probably
not perfectly understand.
Okay, thank you, Ted. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair. In conclusion, I'd like to say firstly, I just heard from the Minister that he has signed the, he has approved the ID investigations, getting police officer powers in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, and that is a huge step forward in terms of the ability of the ID to do its work.
And I just also like to say that just to add to what the body has said about acid forfeiture, I mean and together with the SIU SARS acid forfeiture unit, part of the strategy is not just to hold people accountable and prosecute, but to bring back the money to the country. So this is really important. And in terms of what we've realized is that we would have heard my colleague Mr. Bani talk about Chapter 5 and Chapter 6. So Chapter 5, you know, depends on a criminal conviction. And the challenges with that, as we all know, is that the accused persons are very ingenious when it comes to trying to delay matters so that these cases just never reach finality. And, you know, this, we not, don't have it as part of this presentation, but we really look at various strategies to ensure that you know, we can deal with this. But at the end of the day, all we can do as the NPA is put up really, really good, strong arguments in court. The judiciary also needs to come, you know, to be able to recognize when applications are being brought in bad faith in order to delay accountability. You know, we accept that there must be a fair trial, and it's important that all accused persons get a fair trial in court. But, you know, people escaping justice at the end of the day, it doesn't serve the interests of the country. So we need to strike a balance on that. So we're looking, therefore, more at Chapter 6, which is non-conviction-based recovery. And there, we are looking at really having some really bold and innovative strategies, including engaging with international law firms if necessary, to look at how we can bring back the billions of money, much of which is in jurisdictions abroad. Chair, the other issues in conclusion very quickly is that we are, you know, the collaboration you'll see, we really, the enhanced collaboration between SIU and NPA is really, you know, we can see the fruits of that. And this last week you would have seen the Lotto case preservation order. Also, you know, in the NPA, we are, in addition to all these cases, at the end of the day, Chair, you know, we want to ensure that when our terms are over, we leave an NPA that is, as we say, fit for purpose. So key values of strategic pillars of independence, professionalism, accountability, and credibility are really, really important. We want an NPA that is truly all of those things. And so accountability is really a big part, one of the important pillars. Accounting to Parliament is hugely important. We must try to find that balance between how we account to Parliament, because it's very tricky for us in terms of coming and explaining certain investigations, because even when we mention names of investigations without mentioning the suspects, you know, those that were involved in those contracts, they know who the potential suspects will be. And because of the whole mountain that we need to do, they're aware that these are the cases that are being focused on now. And those that are actually suspects in other matters know that they're not looking at us right now. So we aren't giving away some of our strategies. So we really need to look at how we can balance this, because we see it as a challenge. So I put it there, I think we need to have more engagement with Parliament to see how we can ensure that we strike that balance. But Chair, I'm you know, pleased to say that, you know, we with Justice Archer, I think that's still a lot of work to be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think the last point you make is one which remains in our entry. The Minister, the Deputy Minister of Police has also raised it before. And I'm sure that the necessary guidance will be given to us by the presiding officer. I know that the strength plan of the government but at the same time, I want to reiterate that it's necessary to not delve into the merits and demerits of the cases. We will not venture into that space. I think at the end of each meeting, we need to be satisfied that there's progress on matters. But I think we will deal with that matter with the presiding officers. In terms of the issue of judges, of course, rather, and one day in this committee meeting with how the courts themselves need to be an enabler to the process, and that the court role doesn't move in terms
it's a necessary discussion. The courts themselves have to be agile, and they need to be responsive and sensitive to these matters, so that when there are challenges, we address them, issues of capacity and so on. So I don't think that what you're saying is due observation, as opposed to criticism. We must be understood in that context. The courts must be fit for purpose themselves. When you start with the Umaru Sonia, as you know, in his other life, he's the chair of the Banking Committee of the AEG, so as soon as he is being charged responsible for the excused. I'm told that he is introduced a member because we've not met in a long time. So his honorable man is the far end, the honorable Van Minen, the honorable Lees, and the honorable Sonia. So that's who we are.
Right? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Well, Honorable Members, the entire delegation, with the interesting presentations. I think the last words as a point. The MPA just said they cut a deep nerve on the actual organization of the entirety of this one. You see, if you have a cycle in wanting to succeed, here we are, short SRU, LPA, and the general is the army of the investigators, all of them working on potentially the death of the criminality. Let's say that they've done their work. Done their work quite well. But at the end, all of them are on the road of ensuring that there's justice. There is justice which is somewhat limited in the sense that all those who are involved must at the end be heard and they miss their standard flow in terms of justice. So we don't shy away from the fact that we must meet that kind of thing. Because when we direct criticism at them, not knowing that after the investigation, they would stand frustrated because these cases are delayed, warning steps by those who are involved, and in some instances by them. We have standing scenario. So there's a case which I'm in place to follow, which is taking place in a touch, where someone has been involved for about 7 years now. You see, the case would get into the court, struck off the roll, brought back into the court, struck off the roll, get back into the court, struck off the roll, and the justice delayed, justice denied, and the poor young man was crying for justice for such a long period of time, and such a delay is a heavy delay to an individual who would want to have peace. If you have done the scope of work, why would you have to delay such a kind of instances in terms of that? And showing that such cases would go along. I agree with you as well that at times people want to escape justice one way or the other. we frustrate this process. I'm convinced that this kind of report, which is indicative of the scale and scope of work which needed to be done. The general makes the point that they are scaling up the capacity, and in doing so, you get into a point which we just discussed this morning, that you have delayed in making one appointment to necessary processes, that process. And that delay is cutting into your own ability to be a useful partner in this kind of a circle to fight a crime deeply in the out of page from parliamentary advisory dossier on the same matter, which indeed is one worrisome matter. How are you affected by such? You highlighted a number of other appointments that you want to make, and we read about the failure of some instances to successfully advance the team member. How affected are you around this kind of an aspect? At last, you may have made with the arrest for one critical area over carrying about that is a headway which we so celebrate in terms of such a arrest. Talk about the international relationship case where SARS was involved, in the multiplicity of collaboration in making the actual happening. Can you answer?
This is very complicated. Very complicated case. That's why we don't know. And there was all frustrated ourselves because of the British standard, the Dutch standard, the Dutch standard.
Here we are, after so many years. Then we have somewhat need. So we want to appreciate that itself in terms of your collaboration in dealing with these kinds of issues. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We celebrate all of them, of course. We will also, of course, give the SA an opportunity to make comments where they deem necessary.
Okay.
All right, Honorable Minister and then Honorable Lee.
Thank you very much. I take your point about not talking about individual matters, and I certainly understand that. So I want to address general issues. It really strikes me that when we look at the center of corruption and all kinds of matters that are happening in this country, it really is a very much dead and alive situation, and I really do understand that. It seems like an insurmountable burden. And one thing that concerns me, and I know you can't specifically answer, is when I did not with Greg Stumbosch. I mean, literally out of my class, I think 15 or 20 graduates, there was only one person who went into the prosecution service. So it really, really is a big issue. You've probably got the right avenue, but I think one certainly, and Chair, I think one certainly has to look at how one can make the prosecution service a very much more desirable option for people, and something, you know, prosecutors really are required in South Africa to assist with what we have. I think it really should be seen as a very honourable and valuable profession. But that said, what I really want to get onto is we have had several times now during this term, and I realise the progress is slow, I realise why it is slow, but how many successful prosecutions have come out process to date, or is it still a work in progress? I think it is concerning that we are seeing such a long period between investigation and actually getting to court. So, I understand the cases are being rolled, but is there, and we've discussed a collaborative approach, but is there a prioritization by the courts to deal with these matters? Because looking at some individual cases, you know, it will be moved to the High Court, but the date received for the pre-trial is 8-9 months later. So it really does appear to be a very big delay, and I know the court rolls full, but is there a prioritization, particularly considering, you know, who some of the players are, the quantum of concern? I think it's not unreasonable at all to hope that the justice system will court, so to speak, are also doing their part here and trying to actually get these matters to trial. Then something else, the civil legislative changes with regard to permanence of the investigative directorate. I'm glad to hear about the peace officer issue. What else needs to be done and by whom? You've been asking for Parliament support. Who does that entail and what can be done? Because I think this is something that really does need to be a national effort. In terms of budget, which I know we discussed previously, is there still such a constraint? Has there been any movement in that regard? And in terms of the budget, is the money coming specifically for this investigative directorate, or is it coming piecemeal from the various parties collaborating on it? They were talking about the prosecutors being involved in the early stage, but I'm also seeing in the report that there are matters where prosecutors are agreed to receive and agreed to prosecute. How is that relationship managed? Is there anything that can be done there to either ensure that matters do go ahead, or when obviously doesn't want to go ahead with matters that are not strong cases, so what can be done to strengthen that? Then in terms of asset forfeiture, now this can be a very useful weapon, and I think it's certainly something that the SIU has also talked about on occasion, and it certainly is something that one should be looking at. It's one thing to get prosecution. I mean, when you're dealing with 1.5 billion rand, that money is still gone unless one actually is able to somehow reclaim it. So a couple of issues there. There's talk about non-conviction-based forfeiture. How does that work, particularly in line of the Constitution? And there's a term I'm not particularly aware with, instrumentalities of offences. Someone can just explain exactly what that particular term means. And then there were various terms used with regard to ensuring funds are not dissipated. I thought the term freezing, then of course preservation orders and restraint. What are the differences between those three, or is it essentially the same thing? And then in terms of how that is facilitated, is it the injunction on transferring money? Is it money that's placed into separate account? How exactly does the process work to ensure that money is not then paid out of this space? I think that's it for now. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'll conclude this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to everyone. I haven't said good morning to you, but yeah, I haven't got very much, but the what Victor touched on, the new the extension of the life or the permanency of the IP. What is the parallel between the what you want the IP to be able to achieve and what the Scorpion said? And do you think that there is a possibility of achieving the same kind of authority for the IG as the Scorpion has? If so, we had considerable pushback against the Scorpion, as we all know, and they were disbanded when they got too close to people who didn't want them nearby and who had lots of authority. And so, Honourable Eunice Karim chaired the committee that finally reported to Parliament and it was demobilized. I fear that the IB might be having the same way. some indications of the parallels between the two or the differences. Interesting, General, that you're busy appointing so many people. That's great. And I assume then that your budget has been expanded considerably. Or you've been very slow in making appointments. You've had 50,000 applications. Why is it all time to? Sorry, I'm being facetious now. You don't have to answer that question. But my question really is about your budget. Because it leads on to the NPA budget. We've heard every time you've come that you don't have the resources and your budget, I think last year was a quarter of what the bailout to SAA was last year. What is your budgetary position at the moment? And we just had the MCBP, so we're heading into a new budget season for February. What would you be feeling would be a reasonable change to your budget to make it possible to achieve the goals that we as a department and as society have placed upon your shoulders? Some comments have been made already about the outcomes of investigations and criminal cases and so on. Is it possible in your where you list the investigations and so on, do you have objectives? What Honourable Sylvia was referring to was my favourite one is the fellow Mr. Hermanus, but indeed as I did last time it was some others who have taken action there. You guys still haven't taken action as far as I know. Do you have an objective? Are you going to push the court for a conviction and a 100-year sentence or the recovery of X amount of money? You see, that kind of detail comes in later when you report on the outcome of the cases. But when you're actually in the investigation, in the prosecution, presumably you have an objective that you're trying to achieve. And that, I think, would be of interest. I assume most interest used to that as well. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Honourable Manager.
Honourable Chair, at some point you mentioned that Advocate Mukhtibi will also respond to some of the questions. Because it will be interesting to know that which his department has been dealing with and making referrals, how promptly is it being dealt with, and is it effective, is it yielding any results? I'm asking this question because, Chair, I am seeing the pace of investigation on both documents, on both the HOPS and the NGPP documents. Let me make an example. The case of ABB was reported in 2017. The second case of overpayment. It's still going for, is remanded for 2023. The reason is still further investigation. Meaning 2017 to now, it's been investigation. But the downside of it is that when you go to ESCOM, they use this reason as one of the reasons why ABB cannot be removed, because they somehow, they see somehow a potential of ABB not being found guilty when money was being transferred. So for a person who's sitting at home knowing that, man, they transferred money to Mukhtibi, what is difficult? in finalizing that case. This system agrees the money flow out, that person agrees the money, that other side system agrees that the money was received. So for a layman, it's a case that's very straightforward. And I also don't understand why we would, from 2017 until 2020, we still remanded for investigation. So I'm getting very confused. That is why I'm asking if Advocate Mutibi could also try to clarify his side of satisfaction where processes are concerned. Number two is also the reason that are flagged under the Water Department and why are the investigations still ongoing, in particular the reason of the reluctance of witnesses. Isn't there a mechanism in that regard as far as law is concerned? We can't be delaying cases on the basis that people whom, some of them, according to the information, are part and parcel of the crime. And therefore they are also going to be reluctant, but it speaks to the mechanisms that are at your disposal and also the investigative strength of the department. So this investigation is not done thoroughly. We are going to try and find witnesses that we think are safe witnesses or people who have nothing to do. Meantime, they are deeply involved. That's the deal. Then the third one is PRASA. This one is even worse. With the also, it has similar reasons. But with PRASA, I'm not sure if I'm the only person who sees this as very problematic, because PRASA has collapsed altogether. And there is a syndicate in PRASA. Well, cables can't just be stolen for a mere 100 rand here, and 300 rand there, and 5,000 there. There is a bigger company that is buying this cable. And if we are not dealing with the proper things and putting all the resources into pinning down who exactly is buying these cables, because these cables are not disappearing for a smaller fish. There's a bigger fish, and we are not getting anywhere. That's my problem. Even if the state goes back and refurbish everything in Prasa, we're still going to have this kind of people stealing the cables, while we are pinning a household that disconnects and connects illegally in the household here. But there is a company here that has connections and is getting the cable which the government is putting, is busy replacing in every rail line. So my problem is the strength of investigation, the delay, or rather the ineffectiveness of it. How are we dealing with it? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chen. Good morning to everyone. I've been covered by Honourable Mentor on the platform, but mine is that I think that they will not have included impediments to investigations in this presentation if it was not a worrying factor on your side in terms of the skills of, just to name a few data in terms of dockets. I would just have an interest, are there any cases like that which are falling behind because you would not have the necessary skills? Also, you've listed a whole lot of impediments into investigations, and you, in all of them, are citing that there might be a need for you to get certain kind of skills for you to speed up cases. Now, as a matter of interest, I would just like to know that for us as a committee, how many cases are there that ordinarily would have been investigated but have not been because concluded all the investigations might have begun, but are stuck because of a certain level of skill that is needed in a particular case. I'm saying this, Honourable Chair, because it's the longest in the impediments that have been counted here, but for me, I had an interest on the data center of Docker that ran into terabytes and would require a sort of a specialized skill for you to go into such. And we welcome the presentations, Chair, but as always, we just feel that it is very slow. Because I want to add on what the Honourable Daniela has cited as well, that you are showing us where the cases are, how they are going, but we are looking forward to you coming to us and saying that we've got 20 people behind us because you're prosecuted. And seemingly, it seems like in cases where you do win, it's recovering efforts and to get the state money back. But we don't actually see the real people involved, all of them, because in these cases it's never one person, ultimately. So we're waiting for the day to see, at ESCOM and all these other cases, surely there can't be one person involved and you go and get assets back, because for us to curb this, we really need to deal with the syndicate sort of operation that we have at SOE, because it does not start and end with one person. For you to arrive as the one person who might be the company person that you actually profit and take things to get back the state money. Well, the issue is getting back the state money, but we should get to the root of things, that we stop the syndicate that we have within the institution, because that circle is where the problem is, because the one company might stop, we blacklisted, we get the money back from the state, the company is blacklisted, but the people who operate this are still within the SOEs and the companies themselves. So we are saying that, okay, you can rest, we've got our money back, you guys can start from scratch and get another company and do exactly the same circle that you have been operating on. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you very much. So I actually want to build on that, because it's one of the major areas of observation that I had. There's quite a number of preservation orders that the OPCHED unit has, recoveries and so on. Just yesterday, on the other hand, the SIU was 23 million rand that we got from NSFAS. So what's the progress on the front of getting the finances back? We run the risk of getting the finances back, they will go wherever they go. Only to come back to the same people. I think where we are concerned is that the consequence management does not seem to be people focused. Because corruption is facilitated by people. So I'm just building on what other sources are saying, because I looked at it, the effort for which the unit is, getting out of work, they just start you through the tribunal, and you want the money back. That's good. But the people, and in a case where maybe an arrest is made, it will be some official somewhere. In management, you're finding a needle in a haystack. The big bosses, your police
politicians, your senior management, your executives, somehow they evade jail. I honestly, you can count the people in the past 20 years, high profile people who are behind us. I mean, my own chair by me.
And which spoke it.
Yeah. So that is, I think that we need to go to that. Then, on slide 38 of the NPA presentation on the institutional achievement, the director's shortage bullet point number 2. I'm just raising that in the context that NDVP at some point you indicated, I think in our previous meeting on subject to corruption, that you had a shortage of 700 prosecutors. And then that DOJ was to make funds available to begin the process of filling those vacancies. I just want to check if they pulled through on that commitment. Because I think the other role we have is to ensure that the commitment made to you to enable you to function effectively and efficiently are met. So I've just been playing that matter in my mind as to whether DOJ actually is in the process of making, or did they make the funds available. I flagged the SIU earlier for a reason, that the good work that the SIU is doing, I mean, on the other hand, we're working with the presidency now on building the reporting framework, because you've got SIU reports as far back as 2002 sitting on the presidency, not acted upon. And we raised the issue the minister, actually, I think on that meeting of the 30th, we must also get a briefing from the president on how far they are with the framework that the matrix system that was set must be developed. But I think the flip side of that issue, colleagues, that I was just reflecting on, as far as the SIU is concerned, is on its own funding model. There's a lot of work they're doing. They're doing these investigations. And that money must not be wasted. So all those efforts of the resources they put in. So the reports must actually run their full course and land us at successful prosecution and so on and so forth. So I was just really interested to see that their resources are not wasted. And then the final point that I want to make is to continue to encourage for the sharing and pooling of resources, whether it's the fusion systems or the anti-corruption task, the conveyor belt of investigations, prosecution, successful prosecutions, which arrive at a logical legal conclusion, recoveries, people behind bars, and to continue to encourage that. Because it's helpful moving forward. But I think ultimately, NDPP in general, the issue we have is we see the Gold 6 now, the Gold 7, the Hawks Gold 7. We see it in the early hours of the morning, and then with a big thing, somebody is arrested. And then so the early morning rise of the Hawks Call 7. So in the morning we wake up at 5 o'clock, spun by an ex, got a night ride in that car. And then I think that's where the complaint is for us. Because what we the PR is send the message of being at work, but the PR must translate into tangible
consequences and outcomes. So I think that's where we have issue. Yeah, I don't want to write in a quantum. So let's get responses to those consolidated issues and then come back. And of course, I think we are related to the issue that the NDPP has raised about specific matters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much, Honourable Chairperson. I think there are a few questions that are directed at the DPCR. Starting with the question that was raised by Honourable Somio, or how effective is this affecting the vetting, is affecting the DPCR? Indeed, we have been affected. As I've indicated that we will be appointing one of the senior managers the 1st of next month. We could have done that long time if the vetting was quick. We are currently waiting for more 70 of senior managers that we would like to appoint. But because there is a decision that on senior management, we can't appoint unless there is top secret security clearance. This is affecting us.
If I may interrupt you, I'm sorry, colleagues, the issue would be the previous comment. I'm sorry to interrupt, so that there's context. We are saddled with the problem of the security agency on this meeting. It's a perennial headache across the public. And if we wanted them to come here, it would be a choice out of the court instead of not coming here, they're going to put it on account here. So the meeting of the 30th I'm referring to now we wish to get the Minister to come and speak to the city college, because it's got a material barrier to public finance and the finance. So every time an entity appears, a major increase is raising and it's arising. Okay, so according to me, flag the issue that the chairman is raising and for that to be said, because it has failed in scope. And I think in the correspondence, we said that the third group doesn't include this issue. It's not just confined to ESCOM now, as the whole race. It's just there's a lethargic lies that they face to this meeting. Sorry to interrupt, I thought it fits perfectly with what you are dealing with earlier this morning.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. In our case, while some of the vetting we are awaiting from the state security agency, some we are waiting from crime intelligence, our own. So the majority of this are supposed to come from our own crime intelligence. So, 17 of senior managers that we are waiting is where we are affected. But that is because top secret security service is needed. Overall, the law requires that everyone who is in the DPCI must have some sort of security clearance, although it is not to be on top secret. But even in that area, we are affected, but at least the people are still able to perform while applying for those security clearances. It's only on SMS that we can't take a risk and put you as a senior manager when you do not have a top secret security clearance. So we are waiting on that. We have discussed it with the management that is responsible for this to say that you have to ensure that it's finalized within 60 days. So to give time for those who are doing the vetting an opportunity, we advertise our codes before they become vacant. Like we know that there are managers who are retiring at the end of the year. Within 3 months before that period comes, we budget, I have indicated that we are indeed working very hard to appoint so that we can fully capacitate the DPC. I think that the workload that we currently have on hand requires that we get more hands so that we can be able to speed up the investigation. In this regard, once we finalize this layer of 290 that I'm talking about, which have exhausted the budget, then it means that there shall be a need to get additional budget. And this has been calculated in the region of 1.3 billion. So that is something that those who are working on the budget understand that there is that need. So we will, once we finalize this, only fill the post that has become vacant. Because while we are filling on the other side, others are gaining vacancies because of retirement and the other opportunities elsewhere. It is a matter that once we have a sufficient budget, we can move quicker than the way we are doing. But at this stage, I think that currently, I can say that we have increased the capacity from where we found it. The other question of Honorable Mente, also touching on the issue of the effectiveness of the investigation dealing with the syndicate, which I think indeed, in our investigation, whatever we do, we look at the syndicate, whether within or outside the entity where corruption can have taken place. You'll find that they always work, those within are collaborating with those who are outside. If we are not able to identify the leaders, we deal with those that we find with the items that are involved, but the overall work that we try to identify who are the leaders, who are the receivers of this. That's why at times you find that we go to the scrapyard and the like, we also find some of the owners of the scrapyard, which I think that you may have read in some instances where even the senior officials in the public arena were caught receiving this in their scrapyard. So that is what we try to do, Honorable Chairperson. In the case of, I think that it was also repeated by the Honorable Chairperson, when it comes to the arrest that we do, it may not always be visible for what happens afterwards. We try not to lose these things when they go to court, which is why we have got more than 11,000 accused persons that are appearing in court. You can see a number of them. When a case comes, it's rare where you find an individual. You always find that it is more than one person. Is a group of people that we charge in one matter. So you can think of the high-profile matters that we have placed at court, that it is more than one person. That is what we try to do. I think that the Honorable Chairperson has indicated that it's a goal seven that would be visible in the morning. Once they have taken them, they try to ensure that those cases, we are not losing them. On a daily basis, we read the media statements, because once the matter is at court, you will not be seeing the balls going to court. It's the individuals that are at court. And it is there where I think that publication not really very much visible. But these cases are there on a daily basis. I can guarantee you, Chairperson, I see this on a daily basis, that at any given day, there are cases that are at court. So we shall be seeing how best can one deal with this one. But as I say, that's the collaboration which the Honorable Chairperson is talking about, indeed we are cooperating as ACTT environment. There is also operational committee where we jointly chair, where all the role players are there, the SAS, the SIUFIC, and the like in the fusion center. Indeed, we also work closely with the ID. We have even allowed our investigators to continue working with them. And when they become permanent, we are also discussing on how it is going to unfold, because all of us are interested in dealing with the criminals. While we are dealing with the crime, we also deal with the assets, which is why we also work closely with the AFU. So all the entities we are working with them. When the SIU are doing the raising and the like, we'll join them. When the AFU are going to confiscate the resources, we join them. So that is the collaboration that we have. And then when prosecution are deciding on matters, we sit with them. So that is how we collaborate, and we have agreed that during our era, collaboration is one of those successful recipes that we would like to ensure that it doesn't. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman. I appreciate the assurance that the writing and constant is not a joyride. That's not what I was looking for. So as long as the matters in court, I think that they run their course. That's
important. I'm not sure, is it just by you, NPA? All right. Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members of SCOPA. I'd like to comment on some of the few questions that were related to SIU. Before I go on to specific questions, I want to just give the committee the assurance, Honorable Chair, and this probably goes to the question by Honorable Mente around the progress. We are of the view, and I'm saying we as SIU, individually and as a team member, in the collaboration system that we have, that we are seeing traction and we are seeing progress. We are pleased to see that progress. The collaboration is demonstrating results. Matters are receiving attention. My colleague, Advocate Cook, indicated that we'll be signing the MOU, which now becomes a further instrument that we will use to enhance the collaboration. So, Honorable Chair and Honorable Swart referred to really the effectiveness of consequence management, in particular relating to I would say, individuals, and specifically directors of the company. I think we've mentioned that before, that we need to ensure that consequence management pierces to the directors of the company and not just the entity. And I'll come back to that. So the consequence management that we are seeing and want to strive towards more, Honorable Chair, it's clear that it has for many years been researched, and the deterrent effect of that is undisputed. And that is why we want to strive towards this consequence. We're in agreement. agreement with the honorable committee. The referrals that we made in terms of the law and the attention that they've given, that gives effect to the prosecution part and ensuring that ultimately that conviction or an appropriate result, so to speak. Of course, there's a civil litigation part, and we've seen the importance that the special tribunal is playing. We still have quite a number of matters at the High Court, which my colleague Dr. Wells, and perhaps I should have said, I'm joined by Dr. Wells, the chief legal of SIU, and Mr. Kanyako, who is the spokesperson. So in our engagement with Dr. Wells and his team, we are working hard to ensure that those measures also gain even more traction to ensure increased recovery. On the disciplinary side, and ensuring that there's consequences on the directors as well. So the administrative action that results from our investigation relating to companies, in academic ABB as an example. ABB Meta is receiving attention, as you could have seen, honorable chair, from all aspects. Of course, the investigations still going on. We've heard that some of the methods are as complex, it requires further investigation. But what we need to do, and we are doing that, working closely with the ESCOM management, and we took it further last time we appeared at SCOPA, particularly, I'm using ABB as an example, that when methods are identified, the company needs to be blacklisted. We need to proceed with those, that, and from our side we will ensure that also the directors of the companies are identified and also are taken action of in terms of blacklisting, but the Companies Act is very clear in terms of a declaration for delinquents. We shouldn't shy from ensuring that the appropriate directors are declared delinquent. And I'm talking on all sides, whether it's publicly owned companies or privately owned companies, or state owned companies, across all borders. So we want to assure you, Honorable Chair, that we will proceed and continue on that trajectory. We know that ABB has been retained. And it was retained simply because the ESCOM management said they still needed to do some work that they were doing, but the focus now is ensuring that they don't make profits. And that's clear from the settlement agreement that we met, and the matter will now be at the special tribunal where they have been consolidated into a tribunal order. So that's ensuring on an ongoing basis that there's no profit here in this system. Honorable Chair, there's also the other aspect that we have, and the various appearances we have really demonstrated to the committee, that we really want to see this whole system work and work effectively, including part of our responsibility, which is to improve and work with the state to improve the administration. And this talks to our systemic recommendation in terms of ensuring that the administration, because as we investigate corruption, we also investigate maladministration. And the context of that is that we need to, at the end of it, ensure that the administration improves. And it is our intended objective to ensure that we also improve on the administration of the state and ultimately contribute to the prevention of all these acts from going on. My colleagues have indicated some of the results. I can't overemphasize. Advocate Babaji has indicated that our collaboration has seen the results, and these are just the recent results. There's been others, ESCOM, and then, well, of course, it's not part of the focus area, that here, but it's worth mentioning, and it will be mentioned, the local results, the very things that we have seen there, that they're really satisfactory, and the public is really welcome of those, and we need to really ensure that we improve on that score. Honorable Chair, indeed, from ensuring that this consequence management in all its aspects is implemented, the Honorable Chair is correct that the President has developed a framework, and I'm sure they will be in a good position to appraise or apprise the committee in terms of what the framework is, because that is really innovative, and it will ensure that all the referrals, all those consequence management actions are monitored. As I really conclude on PRASA, the implementation plan that was presented to the Parliament by President, among others, focuses on PRASA. And the various work being done by all of us there, ID, GCI and FIU, but to also take forward the recommendation of Zondo, we will be looking at an amended proclamation to ensure that we now dive deep into what Honorable Mentor said, that PRASA has really collapsed. But the Zondo Commission, and if I quote in so many ways, the Zondo Commission said, we need to dive deep into the causes of what caused PRASA, what caused the ruin. They use the word ruin. They use what caused the ruin at PRASA. And who should be held responsible? The Commission did not have sufficient time, given the timeline that they have, and this is what we will be charged with, and we will be processing a proclamation to that effect. But in the model that we have agreed, in the MOU that we work on and we will be signing, that integrated approach will assist us to ensure that we produce all the results timely, at the time of cost of supported by evidence. Once evidence is gathered, credible, and it enables us to take action, we would like timely action. And we will continue to do so. In terms of funding model, Honorable Chair, this is a matter that really we are pleased that the committee could possibly also assist on. We've raised it several times. We're in engagement with the National Treasury on this aspect, because we believe that strategically the funding model really needs to be reviewed. But what happens is, of course, we charge fees in terms of the law, but Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, in the context of what we do, we investigate the state institution and we also send invoices to the same institution to pay. So the reluctance in many instances to pay is contextualized in that manner. So we believe that there's a case for the funding model to be reviewed, such that it's not dependent on state institutions that we investigate to pay. Just want to see if I might have missed any point. Now I'll appropriate it for the fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much. NGPP.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think the COP will first take questions, then follow back the budget of the tower, and then to SOCO, and then I will just keep up.
I'll deal with the issue of the organisation that has been raised and the self-based of cases moving through the system. In order to do so, I think there's six factors
with the larger complex commercial investigations. Because what it means is, before the prosecutor enters into a courtroom with an accused person, the prosecutor has to anticipate each and every aspect of that case. You've got to consider what evidence do we need to prove. In common law, there's a presumption of innocence, right? And secondly, when an accused person appears in court, there's a right to silence. And that is at the center of why we study in our criminal justice. And that is why we have these huge backlogs, particularly in complicated matters, not just in corruption. You see it in serious violent crime, you see it in our rape cases, and our sexual violence, our gender-based violence cases. You will see the same tendency. When an accused is confronted with a solid case, the default position is that we don't say anything. We will not say anything. Even though they know that there are aspects of that case, because the whole case is given to them. Before the trial starts, the entire case is disclosed to the accused. And the spirit of our system is that there's supposed to be cooperation between the prosecution and the accused. One of the issues in this speech, but unfortunately we have gone into a mode in our criminal justice system that when we contest the issues, the defense often takes the position we contest all the issues. Even though they know there are certain issues that are uncontestable. And so that is why complex investigations in commercial and corruption matters takes time, because we're actually preparing the evidence for court. And we are trying to speed it up. But of course, it is a very difficult issue. So prioritization within the prosecution means that each and every prosecutor has been directed in corruption work, in commercial work, that we need to ensure that those cases get traction in our courts. And then when we come to court, we depend on the presiding officer. And so within this adversarial system, we have a judge, or a magistrate, judicial officer, that must adjudicate the proceedings between the prosecutor and the defense. And so often, we refer to it always as if this individual is a referee in the proceedings. The individual is not aware of the content of the case before the trial. The individual does not get access to any of the statements, like in some of the continental jurisdictions, that actually know what the case are, they know what the issues are that needs to be adjudicated upon. In our system, the presiding officer doesn't know anything about the case other than what we put in a charge sheet or in an indictment. And so I think that's an additional challenge in terms of how the case is managed. And then we are in the hands of the court as the prosecution to get allocated court time. And we do our best to utilize the court time that is allocated to us. But often what happens is, on the day that we are now going to start, we are confronted with another application by the accused. And that application is often designed not to make that case proceed beyond this. Because of the way in which our legal framework is designed, the Constitution and the Criminal Procedure Act in particular, this is where the issue of delay arises. And that is why we are frustrated with the pace within which these cases can move forward. But from our side as the prosecution, we do everything practically. One of the initiatives we have taken is to meet with the Chief Justice at the National Efficiency Meeting, where all role players are present, where we squarely raise this, immediately raise this, in the presence of all the stakeholders, and we ask how best can we move these cases through the court system. The Chief Justice has deliberated with the heads of court, those are the judge presidents of each of our divisions in our province. And they, by agreement, have indicated that we must engage with judge presidents where we have particular long, complicated cases that we are taking into courts. So So that is one measure that we are utilized at the moment, particularly when we're going to bring cases to the High Court. As far as the regional courts are concerned, similar approach will be followed when we engage with the regional court president in terms of how we are going to manage those cases. And then we are bringing engagement with the Department of Justice as well for the creation of additional commercial crimes courts in our country. Currently we have 18 courts, and I must tell this committee that those 18 courts, court roles are really important. That is the extent of the challenges that we are facing in the system. So when we bring any new case onto the court roll, it automatically competes for court time with all the other cases that are already sitting by the court. So it becomes a difficult issue to manage, but we, from our side, we are saying we will constantly engage with the judiciary to see how this can take us forward, and with the legal profession, and with the defense, because we are talking administratively. And my position has always been that when we talk administratively, we must look to the best interest of the country. And this is what is often missed. And that is why people go into these forums and create the worst possible delays that they can. And they miss the point that it's in the interest of everybody to be respected. So from our side of the prosecution, we're working very hard with our directors of public prosecutors, prosecutions, with the prosecutors themselves, to ensure that these cases are completely crushed. I'm sure over the next couple of months, we're going to see more cases coming. We're going to push very hard. We have designed various mechanisms to try and get around these delays. Our prosecutors are going to have a uniform approach to the question of delay. We are going to resist these applications that are going to court. And we're also going to resist the appeals, because that is the further measure that is used. Once the court rules that the case must proceed, the defense lodges an appeal. And then they want to go to another forum. The courts then, because they don't come across as if they are biased against a particular accused, the courts then allow generally that appeal to take place. Once an appeal takes place, you guarantee at least a year delay in terms of getting a ruling. So these are some of the practical challenges, but I think it's important that we just highlight that. But from our side in prosecution, we're doing everything in our power to use the court time that's allocated to us effectively so that we can get this case filed. I think that was one aspect for me. I think the others will be covered by the other part.
Thank you,
Chairperson, for the opportunity. There were four questions asked. What is non-conviction based? What does this mean? If you think of the Constitution, if you basically take in someone's assets away when there's no conviction. So the prevention of organized crime is geared to be a draconian measure to fight corruption and organized crime. The FCA and the Constitutional Court have said that we actually boost those ways. Every country needs the draconian measures to fight crime and organized crime. And the point really, the objective is to take the cost out of crime. So you shouldn't hold on to that which is not yours. So a non-conviction based and asset forfeiture is for instrumentalities of crime as well as process of crime. Now, what are the safeguards? First, let me deal with instrumentalities of crime. Instrumentalities of crime is tainted property. That car that's transporting drugs. That car that is a getaway car for a robbery. That house that's manufacturing drugs. So that thing is property. So people should not use their cars or their houses or their property to commit crime. So it becomes an instrument of crime and it must be taken out of the system. So what are the safeguards? The safeguards constitutionality. And the SCA Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court has really looked at exactly that issue that honourable member is asking regarding what are the constitution says regarding this. So if you're going to take 5 million house for drugs worth 1 million, a whole issue of proportionality gets into play. The court will push back, and we've had adverse judgments as far as proportionality is concerned. So there are things that, as far as non-conviction based adverse forfeiture is concerned. Then the third question was prison restraint preservation. Is it one thing? Yes, certainly. We using the terminology of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, and I think in future we may consider just saying a prison order in terms of a conviction based forfeiture, or we'll say prison order where there's no cops, where there's no criminal proceedings. So we'll just have to use terminology that is acceptable to the committee. How do we save that money in the account until it's in the criminal asset recovery account? I think that's the gist of the question. So if your rate is appointed by the court, it's normally an accountant, a lawyer, someone who's got experience in managing assets. So they wait for the finalization of the case, whether it's forfeiture, which is non-conviction based, or there's a conviction when it's conviction based, to serve the property, to submit an LMD account to the matter of the court, and then thereafter, once that is approved, they deposit the money in the criminal asset account, which is held in treasury. So it's a very stringent process where someone is appointed to the court, gives reports to the court in terms of management of assets. Thank you very much. And if you think, I think I've covered all questions.
Thank you, Honourable Chair of Members. I'm going to deal with the question relating to ABB and the one of notable security matters because of skills. The ABB matter, at the time of the arrest, there were searches and seizures that were conducted, which resulted in the fact that we must then analyze the articles, electronic articles that we faced. So that is what it refers to. The issues relating to whether we don't investigate matters, we don't have skills, we investigate all matters. Where we do not have skills, we sort skills, especially in the private sector. Of course, it comes to the cost, but we do that. So there's no matter that we don't investigate. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. And I'll just pick up on the last point to say that certainly there was a shortage of those very highly specific, specialized skills to deal with these complex cases. But we are, there's two things. One is the budget, the question about the budget. We're pleased to say that we have, received the budget that we would certainly need for this current allocation is sufficient, but we will need to review this once we are, we have more clarity about the ID and its permanence, new powers, etc. And so we would certainly need support in that. But I'll deal with the ID in a moment, just to deal with the skills issue. So we are also looking at, as we mentioned, and as Mr. Sosoma has mentioned, engaging with the private sector to get highly specialized skills. And this is working really, really well. We have an MOU with BLSA, and they have come on board to support us in this regard. But of course, this said, we are acutely aware that we need to ensure that we make independent decisions when it comes to whether to prosecute or not. And so we will at all times ensure that our decisions are guided by the evidence, but we need the skills to help us to get to the point where we have sufficient evidence to make those decisions. just on the issue of the ID, there were a couple of questions that were asked. Firstly, the budget that we've received for the ID and whether it we've received the budget or whether it's coming from various parties. We have received the budget for the ID and it has been ring-fenced for the ID, although it comes through the Department of Justice. For now, as I said, we have sufficient allocation, but we will have to review that. If we look at what needs to be done with regard to the permanence, the first thing that needs to be done is we need to get the legislation through. As I said, in the meantime, we had already started preparing for this as a possibility. So we were already engaging with the Department of Justice in terms of capacitating the ID as a permanent structure, because we realized even before the President made the announcement that fighting corruption is going to be with us for a long time. And so we needed to already start preparing for what needs to be done. So we are looking at a permanent structure now that we have the announcement of the President. All of that work that was being done is now actually useful moving forward. So we need to look at the permanence of the structure, looking at the powers that will flow once the legislation is passed, and then also looking at various partnerships that we need to get involved, we need to ensure the necessary collaboration with all of our stakeholders here, because the ID will be working in this broader context. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that regard. There was a question around parallels between the DSO and the ID. And the methodology will certainly be the same, but the one big difference is that this is specifically the ID will investigate corruption matters and not the broader mandate of organized crime that the Scorpions have, which actually then takes me into the issue that was raised about organized crime and cable theft by one of the honorable members. And you know, this is a serious problem in our country. The DPCI and General Abia are trying to do a lot in this regard, but we have serious problems. I mean, we have to realize that if we, you know, if we don't start thinking about very, very high-level strategies to deal with those that are the organized criminals. And if you look at the recent publication of the Global Index, South Africa, we have serious problems regarding organized crime in our country. And we're not winning the battle. And the question is, what more do we need to do to win the battle? And if you look at various challenges that we have as a criminal justice system, if you look at issues of skills, yes, I think there's a serious problem with skills relating to investigation of these matters. And it's the numbers, but it's also the right skills to deal with these matters. You also, we're looking at, if you look at corruption within our own ranks in the criminal justice system, I think we mustn't forget, and with organized criminal crime, there's so much of money that it can be very tempting, and part of the strategy of organized criminals is to corrupt government people. And so if those in government do not have the highest standards of integrity, because even those with the skills can get corrupted, if we do not have people, the right people, with the highest standards of integrity in government that are prepared to do this work and have really, really good strategies to target those behind the ones that are stealing fuel on the ground, the ones that are stealing the copper cables, all of this infrastructure, we cannot be really utilizing all of the scarce resources across the system to deal with those types of cases. So this is a really, really, a big problem that we need to look at. And it's not just law enforcement. Government has got to look at policies that could be adopted that makes it difficult for organized criminals to operate. For example, the one good thing that government's looking at now is the ban on, although it's temporary, on the exportation of certain types of scrap metal. So, you know, we really need to look at what policies can government actually put in place that helps law enforcement to do its work. because there's serious challenges, and our country is on a bit of a, I think I'm being diplomatically slow when it comes to organized crime. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And so if we look at the other questions that have been asked, the issue of vetting came up. I just want to say that, as you say, Chair, this has been a perennial problem and challenge. We have been engaging with the new DG in FFA, and I'm pleased to say that there is some movement in the NPA with certain key positions. We also tried to get, vetting faster, expedited in the ID. And so the DDG of FFA has even indicated to us that they can look at a new process that allows the entity itself to do a lot of the preliminary work, and then they come in at a later stage and do the final assessment. And I think perhaps the DPCI needs to also, if the general hasn't already, to start engaging. I think that's really important, because if we can do that, we can assist FFA. Otherwise, it's a huge problem when it comes to various issues. For example, if our people don't have top secret clearance, they don't have access to some of the key documents that are needed for these investigations. Honourable Chair, members, the other issues that were raised, I think you raised the issue, Honourable Chair, about low-level politicians, etc. I think in the context of corruption, we certainly, I think we mustn't forget about where we come from as a country in terms of fighting corruption. And it's been the depletion of all of the skills and what happened in the past century, both in the DPCI and the NPA. You need to build these capacities first before you can do this. But I'm really confident with the work that's happening in the DPCI, with the work that's happening in the ID, that it's kind of like a snowball effect. It's been grinding in the beginning, but you can see this momentum, and again, our collaboration together with General Zabia, it's not just General or Lady General, it's actually Doctor Advocate General. So that's kind of a statement. But with the work that's happening, with capacitation in the office, with the ID now getting a bit more peace in terms of legislative changes, with us getting the budget that we need, I'm really confident that things are going to start rolling more. With AFU working very closely with FIU, and we're also working very closely with SARS, because while some of these corruption matters take a long time, we are working very well with SARS in identifying certain tax-related cases. Because with all of these organized crime and corruption as well, it's all about the money. So if we can deal with some of, and we are dealing with some of these tax-related matters quicker. So, as I think that was one of the questions raised about, do you have objectives? Yes, we have case strategies with all, I think that was one of the weaknesses of the IED in the past in terms of having really good case strategies. So now, if you look at a big case like ESCO or any of the SOEs, it's a huge effort. And you've got all our partners sitting together to say, how do we actually eat this elephant? What are the strategies that we need to have that enables a particular entity to go at a particular time, and also enables us to ensure that we're very clear about how we need to eat this big elephant. So case strategies are really an important part of how we move forward, whether it is AFU, FIU, looking at tax, looking at, ultimately the prosecution. We are looking at, and even in the municipal space, corruption takes a long time, but one of the strategies was, let's look at PFMA, MFMA, contravention, so that those are, statutory offenses that we can move quicker on. So yeah, we're really trying to look at how we can use this elephant with all of the various strategies. It has been long. I was 4 years in office in February. I really thought it would be quicker. But with the amount of groundwork that needed to be to really capacitate law enforcement and, to get the necessary power, the skills, we, like many, we also sit a bit of the country. But we have the, the opportunity to really try to do something about it. So we've been working really hard at building these foundations, but I've been confident that, you know, with the IED now being permanent, with the enhanced collaboration and our strategy, that the country is going to see certainly a lot more cases coming through in the coming months and years. Thank you very much, Chair. I hope we've covered everything.
I think you heard of PPP advocate Dr. General, and head of units of respect to I want to be like the MDPP now, the delegate of I think there is an appreciation on our side that the law enforcement agency in the crime prevention sector was specifically and deliberately targeted by the agents of state capture. There's no doubt about that. It was a deliberate erosion of capacity in those spaces. And so there would have to be considerable efforts to rebuild those entities in order for them to be fit for purpose and for them to be able to respond to their mandate. Having said that, we do not have the luxury of time. So whatever efforts are being made, we need to double and triple the pace. Because the illusion we must not create is to think that state capture is the reality of the past. It remains with us in different forms and different realities. Because the agents of state capture of the past will not rest as they protect their ill-gotten gains of the past in this present. So we must confront that reality, that in one way or the other, state capture remains a reality of our times. I know that a former public protector, Matosela, always makes the point that it's state of capture, and somehow we ran into this colloquial term of state capture. And I think there's a marked difference between state capture and state of capture. But in any, whatever way you look at it, that fundamental reality anchored in corruption exists. So the urgency of it cannot be downplayed, because the longer we take to fix the problem, then it persists and entrenches itself in different forms. It unfortunately then, rightly or wrongly, falls on your shoulders. Our support where we can to ensure that the resources and infrastructure that you need takes place, we will continue on our oversight role. That's why we insist on these meetings regularly, so that we know how far we are and how far we still need to go. So the only way for me where corruption sort of finds itself uncomfortable is when there are people behind us. The consequences must act as a deterrent. So what we don't want, and I think this is just a general public observation direction, is that it's very easy to have an out of court statement say, I'll pay back the money. I know you have a phrase at some point, pay back the money. And avoid change. No. Every settlement must run parallel jail time. I'm a strong advocate for Tabantumaboshi. Because this, the ease of paying back
So, anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that state capture, in one way or the other, remains a component. So what we'll do is we will give you the space and time to do the work that you need to do, and I think we'll probably be taking at the end of the first quarter of 2023, so that would be end of May, maybe April roundabout, so that we can continue doing the work that you need to do. If there's anything urgent, we will be in communication. I want to thank the NDPP, the head of Hawks, the head of units, and his respective teams for the very comprehensive briefing that we have received this morning. And so we will meet at the end of April, the coming end of March, the April National Treasury and AG, thanks to you as well. My colleague, thank you, and to our very keen. On a lighter note, in the PP, maybe next time you can say eat the rhino or something. Because they close the finish to the end of the other
company. Yeah, they don't even the rhino. Eat the hippo.
Yeah, the hippo. Because it's my other company. The elephant is something.
I'm
trying
to animal rights to
share with them. This is a bit serious. All right, we'll see. Next week, Tuesday, we are dealing with National Treasury on the instruction notes 3 and the changes that they affected there, and the perennial headache, which at some point you will have to engage with yourself, the IFMS, which has been settled with National Treasury in 2006. And you know that it is at the heart of the dispute of the audit outcomes. So we need to deal with it and see if it comes. And then on Tuesday, on Wednesday, colleagues, we have SAPC hearing on their annual report and SIU's investigation focus area will come out tomorrow. And then on the 29th is the CASA hearing, and then on the 30th is the next 2 weeks, happy reading, God for reading, enjoy. Once again, thank you very much and safe travels. And if we don't meet, we should get festive speaker. Colleagues, the house is the 3 questions, and then the Dora will be here to be about after 7. Take care.